Guys, I think they did it. It's rare for a geek to admit it, but I think Fuller and his team did the impossible.
What do you mean there, Dwayne?
I know what he means.
Then you know why I've fallen for this show.
What? Really?
It may be.
I think it is.
I really don't know. What are you guys talking about?
The American Gods show is
better
better
than the
than the
book.
book. At least up to episode four, anyhow.
Definitely. Should we get into it?
Yeah, let's do it. So, hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast, episode four, Get Gone. We are your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Andrew Cercini, and we've got Tosin Anafwakan with us once again. We just watched the fourth episode of Starz, American Gods, titled Get Gone. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. So let's dive into the aftertalk. But first, let's catch you up on how to reach us. Here are our online links. You can follow us on Twitter at Gods Podcast or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. You can write or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. You can add us on iTunes. And if you do so, please like us and leave us a review. That's how we get noticed for the show. All right, Dwayne, why don't you give us a brief recap of episode four, Get Gone?
You got it. Okay, here's the quick recap. Laura works as a dealer in a casino. She lives alone. She's depressed, disillusioned with life. She tries to kill herself in her hot tub with bug spray and fails in the attempt. The next evening at work, she encounters Shadow for the first time. He tries to steal from the casino. She warns him that there are video cameras and he'll get caught. She tells him to leave. Shadow waits for her to come out of the casino at the end of her shift and thanks her for helping him, admits that he fancies her. Laura takes Shadow home. They make love. They start a relationship. Shadow teaches Laura some card tricks, some talent with his talent, and he becomes part of her life and becomes friends with her and her best friends, Audrey and Robbie. Laura and Shadow get married. Shadow begins working in Robbie's gym. Laura falls back into depression, declares she needs to rob the casino. She just has to. She has a perfect plan. Shadow gets caught, despite her perfect plan, gets sent to jail. Laura says she'll wait for him for 3 years. Laura's cat dies, and she begins an affair with Robbie, agreeing the affair will be over when Shadow returns from jail. Upon Shadow's return, she and Robbie have one last tryst in his car, and they die. She is destined to spend the rest of her eternity in her hot tub where she attempted to kill herself. Somehow she wakes up, is back in the real world, and she climbs from her coffin, sees a bright light, which she follows to Shadow. She finds him being lynched and kills all of those around him, hurting her arm. And she goes to Audrey's craft room to sew her arm back, and Audrey confronts her. They encounter Mr. Ibis and Mr. Jackal. They find and repair her arm, repair her skin, and Laura understands that she's dead and is compelled to confront Shadow. We actually end this episode exactly where we ended the third episode. And that's kind of incredible because it just happens through her perspective and not his. And that's the recap. But let's get to the salient points. Number one for me was that there's this moment where Shadow is effectively like, hey, have you ever noticed that everyone gets quiet at the same time at like 22 past the hour. I hadn't heard that before. I thought it was interesting. I thought that the reason everything got quiet at once was some stylistic thing, but the fact that the characters recognized it as well was also really interesting. So that was kind of surprising to me. And then another thing that I noticed was cats, right? We've got, you know, Laura has a cat. She says, my grandma always had cats. She says they could see ghosts. And last week, the Egyptian woman had a cat, Mrs. Fadil, who not only followed her to her place of judgment and interacted with her after she had fallen from the stool and was dead. You know, she's talking to it. She's saying, you know, my son sounds like you. The cat's meowing back. It also pushes her into the afterworld. So that's pretty interesting as well.
Right.
And then finally, in the funeral home, we've got a cat there, which makes a lot of sense if we've established that cats can see ghosts, can see the dead, because it makes a lot of sense that a cat is would be kept there, that kind of thing. Tosin, what about you?
Yeah, so I know last week we talked about the role of luck. We had Mad Sweeney, who was facing a lot of bad luck because he couldn't find his gold coin, which he still wasn't even able to recover as he searched in Laura's grave. And this year we see a continuation of the bad luck, but in these circumstances it's kind of with Laura in particular. She had bad luck at the casino, where once she decides she wants to go through with the heist, Shadow ends up being caught and is sent to prison. Bad luck with a cat that dies and sort of passes away. She may not have liked it, but it sort of brought her to tears and kind of continued her descent into the path which ultimately killed her. And, there's bad luck kind of with Shadow. I think it's a combination of Shadow and Laura here, where Shadow didn't want Laura to go to jail. I think part of that was because he really cared for her, but things may have been different if they were both serving short sentences and she wasn't out on her own.
I totally see that. I mean, this whole the whole discussion with him saying, hey, look, I got caught. I'll be out in 3. Can you wait? Her saying, yeah, I can wait. And you looking and wondering if she's going to make it because of what we know about her. That was pretty badass. And then also, I think what was also really well done was I've got the perfect plan. And then there's a beat and then they're in jail. that was kind of incredible. What also got me in terms of a salient point was, Laura sings this weird song. She says, she's like, I really like this song, when she's about to go down and give, oral sex to Robbie as he drives the car. Mm-hmm. She says, I really like this song. Will you sing it to me? Like, what was that?
Yeah, that's The Wait by the band. Classic 70s tune. And if you look into the text of that, the lyrics, there's a lot there. I picked up my bag, went looking for a place to hide. When I saw Carmen and the devil walking side by side, I said, hey, Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I got to go, but my friend can stick around. Take a load off Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off Fanny. And you put the load right on me.
So there's sort of a lot of sexual innuendos in what's going on, as well as in the song, right? So going downtown, of course, Laura is doing something dirty and going down on him. Another, reference to fellatio, take a load off for free. And then there's more about putting the load right back on me. So it's all sort of a sexual innuendo there. And what's kind of interesting about that whole scene, right, is I think Laura is trying to absolve Robbie of the affair. She says, hey, I want you to forget that any of this ever happened, because Robbie wants to leave his wife and wants to run away with Laura, and wants
she's
Laura to
that.
Like be for Shadow, right? She's definitely not having that. And so this is sort of the last kiss goodbye, right? The last action to say
the last hurrah, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, the last hurrah, right?
The last action for sure. Good call.
Yeah, and it was a deadly one.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's also worth noting that in the actual death of the two, it's Laura who changes the gear shift from drive up to neutral, which means that Robbie can't accelerate away from the oncoming tractor trailer, which is why they die. So not only is she sort of responsible for the affair that gets them in this position in the first place, she's also responsible for their deaths. And another great shot.
Yeah, she literally drove him off the edge, right?
She drove him off the edge, and that eyebrow crinkle, that frown right before her last the last shot on her face before she dies, it's a little jarring. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Right before the car crashes. It's stylistically beautiful the way the car is sliding on its side and like a body gets flung from it and all that stuff. But that one sort of superhuman look from her is interesting to me, because I think we think about when we hear that, Robbie and her were hooking up right before they died and it's the cause of their death, it's very easy to kind of like make the japes and also kind of think about it in like kind of almost like a pornographic way. And the mundane nature of the sexual act was really interesting to me. She's like, I like this song you're singing to me, which is just very strange. I think it was what everything that you guys read makes sense in terms of like what it means from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah.
But from a character asking another person to do it, that's also interesting, as if she couldn't hear it when she was on his body. But then also that one little frown, that one bit of humanity, where she's like, wait a minute, that was really interesting. But then they're dead, right, Tosin?
Yeah, and you see Laura sort of like looking down at the crash. It's all really beautiful, and I think Craig Zobel, the director of this episode, is one to thank. But, you know, I want to kind of hold the discussion of why Laura was being judged by, you know, an ancient Egyptian god later. But did you guys notice the difference between this and the Egyptian death scene we had last week, the lady in the kitchen?
Well, I mean, it was darker. It was like literally darker. Anubis, the god, you know, the one who in the previous episode with Mrs. Fadil, she had her heart measured on the scales, and her heart was as light as a feather. So it was, you know, there was a lot of kindness in it. And this was like literally the 180 degree, you know, antithesis of that scene. Laura was having none of it.
She was having none of it, and Anubis was having none of it, right? Like on some level, you know, Anubis, on his way upstairs with Mrs. Fadil last episode, you know, he went from wearing the black cloak of death into this kind of like white thobe, and like the sun is shining and the sand is this beautiful golden color.
Yeah.
And what we have here is, you know, he's only wearing black. There's no change. Despite the fact that the feather is white, the sand itself is black. There's no sun outside. All of it's visually different. It's also worth noting, later on, you were talking, Tosin, about the weird, the Egyptian-ness. You know, she's wearing like an Egyptian dress when she meets Shadow. So that's pretty, like an Egyptian motif dress. So that's pretty interesting. But speaking of visual motifs, last week we had blood. The week before, last week we had precipitation. The week before, it was blood. And the week before that, it was lynching. This week, you know, the one thing that I kept on seeing were these flies, right? You know, flies are the reason why she had the suicide attempt. She shoots the fly down with a bug spray. Having the bug spray in the first place, she shows that she's been dealing with this for a while. She goes in the tub to kind of gas herself. Doesn't work. Flies are all over the craft room when Audrey is trying to sew her arm back up. Flies are in the funeral home. Mm-hmm. And when she's dead and waiting for Shadow, she realizes this, and the flies are all over the, you know, she puts up fly paper just to make sure. Now, how all these flies get in the room is unclear. But the fact is,
it's a metaphor for decay, which is
right. It's almost as if she had a spiritual decay.
Yeah.
Before she was dead. I guess if the flies were ready to feast on her before she even died. And now that she's dead,
they're coming full blown.
Exactly.
Another thing that I noticed here is that Laura's vision is muted. It's dark, and it's grainy. You know, it's basically like undead vision, and through that undead vision, there is one bright shining light that pierces through the darkness, and its shadow. And we're going to talk about that in depth a little bit later. That's the salient points of the episode we just talked about. But let's get into the big picture, which is how the events of this particular episode impact the overall series story arc. Tosin, why don't you start us off?
Sure thing. Let's talk about the supernaturals we meet this week. So we'd previously met Anubis, Mr. Jaquelin.
I guess you mean Mr. Jackal? Tosin Peel, all right. Why are we talking about him again?
Well, we'd only seen him in supernatural form, but now we actually get to see his real world counterpart. So we see him in sort of his dog canine form when he stops the car that Laura is in. So Anubis is the name of the god associated with mummification and the afterlife in ancient Egyptian religion, and we discussed last week that usually depicted as a canine or a man with a canine head. So with Ibis, Jaquil, sorry. I can't do so.
Okay, we'll just call him Mr. Jaquillin. Okay, that's fine. Mr. Jackal is Mr. Jaquillin.
Isn't it Jackal? Why isn't it Jackal?
It's Mr. Jaquel. It's like Stephen Urkel. It's Jaquel.
But I mean, I thought it's like Jackal, like a jackal, like the.
Well, then it wouldn't have a Q. U. It would just have like a K.
Right, but I think it's pronounced Jackal, like the.
I think if you put that Q. U. in there, you get a Jaquel.
I'm with you, man.
Okay. All right. So who's this asshole? His asshole has he's been in the funeral business with Ibis for like 200 years in Eagle Point. Andy, who is Mr. Ibis?
Mr. Ibis is Thoth, the ancient Egyptian god Thoth. We don't need to go into too much detail about him. According to some Wikipedia research we did, we understand that in the later history of ancient Egypt, Thoth became heavily associated with the arbitration of godly disputes, the arts of magic, the system of writing, the development of science, and the judgment of the dead. Ibis is the one who records the coming to America and somewhere in America scenes, which ties in nicely to the system of writing. And Ibis also works in the funeral home with Anubis, a.k.a. Jaquel, Jackal, Jaquelin.
Whatever.
Which also,
the big dude with the feather.
Yeah, which links him to this judgment of the dead.
Yeah, we have one more supernatural, and that is Laura Moon. We know that she's not a god, but she definitely falls into this category. So let's talk a little bit about how she's dead. As Dwayne mentioned, with the flies all around, we know that she's rotting, but she's super powerful. So she saves Shadow from some of the bad guys who are coming at him. And she actually punches people's spines out of their bodies and makes them explode. So
physically, she's like if Wonder Woman or Rogue didn't hold back when they fought.
Yeah, exactly.
It answers the big question that we had at the end
of the pilot,
which is who was it that rescued Shadow from the lynching?
Right. We also wondered if it was like a dream, right? The whole lynching scene, because it seems so out there. But now we know it was some level of reality.
Yeah. From Techno Boys, mobsters.
Yeah.
So we also know that she's not immune to damage because she got her arm sort of chopped off, but it seems that she's immune from pain for the most part, although she was having some stomach issues with the embalming fluid, which turned out to be a comical moment, bathroom humor.
My guess is that's not the last we'll see of her internal distress.
Yeah. She does see in muted colors that Andy noted, but one thing that is quite clear is Shadow is this bright beaming light that she sees in the distance that is sort of her guiding light.
That's a great soap opera.
Yeah. And as she waits, time seems to mean less, and maybe that's possibly because she's dead, but it seems like no care is there.
Yeah, I mean, that last point, I mean, remember, it's kind of like if you've seen the Terminator 2, when he's waiting at the place where they repair the car or whatever, he just stands there and like the sun, he's all through the night and the sun comes up and they're ready to go. She's sitting there as time passes and she's effectively super still. Now, if you're a person and you feel pain all the time, and when I say that, I mean, when you're sleeping and you roll over, that's because on some level your brain is registered that there's pain on one side of you. And you have to relieve the pressure on you. And so you roll over to the other side. It's not pain as an ouch. It's just, it's actually your pain receptors. In fact, people who have problems actually feeling pain. They're rare. They can hurt themselves by sitting too long in one position. Nowadays, they have timers and stuff to move. And she's just there. And I think it's because she's dead and she doesn't feel that pain. But I also wanted to talk about, now that she's dead, you know, even before she was dead, there's a certain, like, super rationality to Laura, right? It's kind of like she doesn't give a fuck, but now that she's dead, she really doesn't. And, you know, she understands that her arm is broken for whatever reason, right? It gets lopped off with a super hard hit from a crowbar. And that means that minion had to be somewhat powerful to knock off someone's arm. Yeah. Granted, she's dead, so it may come off a little easier than if she weren't. But the fact that it doesn't faze her that she needs to sew her body back on, and she's so rational. She's like, where are their sewing supplies? Audrey has a craft room. I'm going to go to the craft room. I'm going to try to sew my arm back on. Now, you know, she can't do it herself. Audrey ends up doing it. It doesn't quite pass muster. Ibis and Jackal are, you know, experts at this. Yeah. They have to put severed limbs back on people all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be, you know, sturdy enough so that they don't fall off in the coffin or in the why can't I remember the name of the limousine that carries the coffin?
The hearse,
right? That kind of thing. But she doesn't get phased, right?
Yeah.
When she sees, you know, Audrey, she's like, I'm coming in the bathroom, right? I got to talk to you. And it's not kind of like, there's no shame there. And that's one thing that we don't see in Laura. We don't see a lot of shame. It's partly because of her rationality.
Well, so there's the whole turn away while I drop a deuce.
Right. That was actually really interesting because she's like, I got to talk to you. She's not like, I'm ashamed or whatever. And I guess she doesn't actually realize that people know that she like died with like a man's penis in her mouth. But she breaks open the door without even thinking. She goes, I'm coming in knowing that she can break open the door because that's what she needs to do. She sits down, and it is really comical when she's expectorating the embalming fluid from her body, right? She's managing it very well. I think a lot of our depiction in Hollywood of females, especially small, frail ones of the shape of Laura, or like, you know, sexualized, voluptuous ones of the shape of Audrey, is kind of like a super feminine, women don't use the bathroom like that, or, you know, whatever. I mean, countless guys I know say, oh, ladies never poop, that kind of nonsense. And the fact that she's kind of no holds barred, like, and whatever sound effects they use, like, there's a lot going on that's coming out of her body. And the weird thing is, she's really, I wouldn't say comfortable with it, but she understands what's going on. She's like, this is strange. It's most of us would be like, oh my God, embalming fluid's coming out of me. But when she vomits it or when she, like, defecates it, it kind of, it's kind of rote to her, which is really interesting. And what's really interesting to me about that whole thing is that when you think about Shadow in the book, that's how he is. And he's not pissing out embalming fluid or whatever, but he takes a lot of stuff in stride. He runs in to characters left and right who are just zany and weird and strange, and he runs into situations that are really weird and strange, and he kind of comes at it the way Laura comes at it in the show. Like, okay, I can handle this. I can deal with this. I can do this. Without even having to say that. It's just kind of, all right, this is the situation, this is the rationality I'm going to use. That was pretty powerful in terms of understanding who this character is that we didn't really get to know in the book, and that's really being expanded upon in the series. One of the reasons why I think this episode is A, the best of the four we've seen so far, and B, is taking the story that the book is to a whole new level.
So, about Laura in particular, I've got a question here. What's the source of her life? Is it her freedom from the hot tub?
A hot tub time machine? Well, I mean, if we follow the text, we know from last week that Mad Sweeney went looking for his coin, and we know the coin broke through the coffin.
Yeah, and the next thing we saw after that shot, when he's like holding up the coffin with the hole in it, that we know the coin broke through, was Laura in her white and gold dress waiting for Shadow when he arrived back in the hotel room. So we can definitively say that the coin has something to do with her revival, with her kind of getting pulled from the beginning part of the netherworld.
So all of that begs the question, now what's going to happen to Mad Sweeney now that he doesn't have his life-saving coin, his sun coin?
Yeah, I mean, Shadow now has the moon coin before Mad Sweeney gave him the sun coin. I mean, Matt Sweeney seems to have worse luck than Shadow did getting caught with the casino.
Yeah.
And having his wife die, you know, a couple days before his release from prison. So it's very unclear what happens to Matt Sweeney. But
I guess the thing with Matt Sweeney is so far the bad luck it's kind of been more tangential, right? So
it hasn't
hit
him directly, right?
Right. It's been like the people around him. So maybe his leprechaun status gives him a little bit, but it all seems to be closing closer and closer, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think he's definitely got some bad luck, as I just noted, but Shadow definitely has direct bad luck, right? So for instance, we know the whole plan, right? This perfect plan. And then somebody, you know, Laura thinks someone may have like fucked them over because she right. said
That's
she knew everything.
Her actual quote was, "The plan was a perfect plan. Somebody fucked us."
Yeah, is there something to that? You know, we know that Wednesday is a trickster, and we know there are other sorts of tricksters in this world. Mm-hmm. Is there a chance that Shadow was getting caught as part of his plan?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that maybe in the grand scheme of things, there may have been a larger plan in place that Shadow being put in prison may have been the ends to the means of this plan. So there may be a larger plan that necessitated Shadow ending up in prison. So it may not be so happenstance as it is.
Yeah, you know, I see that, and I also see like when we first meet Wednesday, he kind of has all these answers, and he's always like, "Oh yeah, I got a job for you," or this. You know, it's really convenient, right? And we know that you feel that it's whack when you first meet Wednesday, especially because he like cons himself into first class. There's that scene where they're robbing the bank in episode 3. Right, right before they're robbing the bank, you know, he's getting Shadow that coffee or the hot chocolate, and he's doing this thing with the money and yada yada yada. It's kind of sketchy. He's a con man, and we also know that, you know, if he can do the bank thing, which also is a huge con, he's conning cops, right?
Yeah,
he could be into the long con. He just seems to be the guy who's holding all the cards. For lack of a, you know, sorry, no pun intended, since there are cards everywhere in the whole thing. But he seems to be the guy holding all the cards. And the idea that, like, somehow they ended up in trouble is also really interesting.
I'm going to say, for those of us, now, all three of us have read the book, American mm-hmm. Gods. And for those of us who read the book, I know the answer to this question. But let's just, for argument's sake,
so I get what you're saying, but at the same time, this story has taken significant departures from the book right here and mm-hmm. right now. This episode could very well be a turning point that is very much away from it. So from what we've seen in the show so far, it's super sketchy that the plan was perfect. And we also know Laura was like a super rational person who, when she first met Shadow, was like, "Dude, you're going to get caught because of XYZ and ABC." Yeah. You know, she had figured things out. Now, she's not a dummy. She's got bad judgment when it comes to, like, you know, men and, like, life choices. But at the same time, it's surprising that she could have such a perfect plan, having worked there for 8 years, all that stuff, knowing all the security, and that Shadow got caught, boom, just like that, at least the way we've seen it. So that's interesting. But there's, it's also interesting. Speaking of life choices, Laura, Robbie, that relationship. Andy, what do you think?
Well, this is, you know, we're getting to see that whole backstory between Laura and Robbie and all the stuff that was going on while Shadow is in jail. Robbie offers to invite Laura to sleep on the couch, and then she advances on him. Her fault. She sets the terms. She breaks it off. You know, it's sort of, we get to see the genesis of what happened in the, while Shadow was away at prison. And, we'll get into this a little bit later, but this is all sort of a backstory that was an invention for the series. 'Cause it's not in the book. Although we kind of knew what we knew about it. We didn't know the details. So this, all this,
it stuff, didn't feel super real necessarily. I mean, I guess it happened, but yeah, you didn't, like you said, you didn't hear any details. So it was hard to like kind of pin down from an emotional perspective. And it kind of, in the book, I almost feel like, you know, she's painted as a, she's kind of a non-character in that respect. Like, what led her to that? Like, you have to make all these decisions and judgments. And here with this story, there's a significant amount of sympathy, but at the same time, what's really interesting is that this entire relationship was on her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and Laura now has more of a personality than she ever did before. So I think that's a really big part. She has sort of motive, and you understand who she is. And when it, in terms of, you know, her interactions with Robbie, she was really the one in control. She, you know, she essentially had him by the balls and, you know, pulled him in. And
so what did that mean for him? Like, when, like, so we know how she started the relationship, but like, talk to us a little bit, Tosin, about what Robbie's kind of newly explored character was feeling emotionally toward Laura, and why that's significant.
Well, I think he was actually in love with her, and I think he sort of liked I think he liked her controlling the relationship and controlling the situation, and her sort of definition. And it appears that Laura was giving him something that, you know, his wife wasn't at the time, or at least there was much more of a connection between them.
I buy that. I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, she's there, and toward the end of the relationship, actually at the end when they die, she, you know, Robbie's trying to discuss about how they could leave people or whatever. But to your point, she's giving him something he didn't get from his wife. She says, you fucked around, you had some excitement, your life isn't meaningless, you did something. You know, when you're old man, you realize you were bad, right? You were badass for a second. You weren't just some guy who could kind of got along to get along. You weren't like this kind of average dude. You stepped out of bounds, and that's worth something. And I thought that was interesting, considering her kind of like mundaneness and depression about everything. But yeah, he was. What's interesting to me is that his character, which is now being explored in the show, he lives a life that was pretty much, it seemed, controlled by Audrey. But he liked being controlled by Laura, whatever Audrey's control was. And it's not like Audrey was, you know, some slovenly, messy, disgusting person, right? The actress playing her is, you know, beautiful. And I think that the actress playing Laura is similarly beautiful, but in very different ways. So there's this kind of exoticism that exists in the gulf between their two physicalities and the way they're representing themselves, the way the characters are represented on the screen, right? Laura kind of melancholy, Audrey kind of like bossy, and eventually getting vulgar because of all the pressures put on top of her. So I thought that was really, really interesting. Anyone want to say anything else about the whole way Robbie was feeling about Laura?
I mean, I think he, you know, it's sort of a thing where it's like both these characters are in a state of vulnerability. You know, and these things happen sometimes, and it takes two people really to for something like this to happen. So, you know, it's just a nice dimension to that's added to her backstory. This is the Laura story, and it's nice that we have this episode that is essentially her whole backstory.
Right. I think that's a good point. As much as I said it was all her fault, you know, I kind of alluded to the fact that it was all her fault with the relationship. It does take two to tango. I think she was able to recognize a vulnerable Robbie. And I also think that on some level she may have needed that in order to survive for those 3 years in order to reconnect to Shadow. But speaking of that, let's talk about the power of belief. Last week we spoke about this power of belief. We saw the Egyptian woman, Mrs. Fadil. She was basically saved because of her belief in her Tita, her grandmother's teachings about the old world. We see the Omani man who's saved from his dull job by the Ifrit or the Jinn. And his grandmother taught him about those stories, right? But Laura has no beliefs, right? She's talking to Shadow. She's asking, like, Shadow, what did you think? What do you think about the, you know, this, all this stuff, this kind of like religious stuff? And Shadow's like, well, you know, I talked to my mom, and, you know, when she was alive, and she said, all I know is that there's more than I know. And Laura's like, I mean, that sounds smart, but without knowing certain terms, she's like, it kind of is stupid. When you die, you rot. There's physics and yada, yada, yada. So she doesn't have a belief system. So it's kind of like, what did that mean? What's going to become of her? Andy, why don't you talk about that?
Well, you know, she's rejected the next stage. She's rejected moving on into the next world. So it's sort of stuck her in this afterworld, and she's like this thing that exists between two worlds, and part of that is because of her attitude, and part of it is obviously because of the Sun Coin, which is a major part of that. And so she's kind of living in this for a want of a better phrase, behind the scenes, you know, behind the scenes of the real world. And I think we're going to see more.
Maybe that's
of that.
Why she can't see it the way we see it. Not just because she's dead, but because she's kind of phased out into this behind the scenes space.
Yeah. And I'm fairly certain we're going to see more of that in episodes to come.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because we don't necessarily see the Sun Coin, but we know that it's present, or it somehow may be the thing that is giving her a bit of this like afterlife luck. But yeah, I think what I really love is just her sort of her attitude, her sort of Daria style.
Irreverent.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Which is important because she's irreverent in the face of a god, right? But that brings us to how she ends up in front of an Egyptian, you know, in the afterworld, and she believes in absolutely nothing, right? That's got to be a question for people. Like, how does she end up in front of this Egyptian dude when she doesn't believe in anything? And I don't know about you guys, but I think it has everything to do with the theme of the casino, like a proxy default thing. What do you guys think?
No, I mean, I think that I don't know that. Well, maybe. I mean, there might be something there too. Like she
the
carries
is the Anubis, right? So the big thing, the card on the deck is Anubis. So on some level,
you think it
could
be
a tiny fractional belief that Anubis is important,
right? That she's carried the belief from her workplace into the next world. That's how she gets right. In front of Anubis and not some other afterlife god.
Oh, that's very interesting because you know she hates the machine. She wants to be in control of the cards. She wants to be the dealer.
And
so
she's
that's
doing blackjack
why
where the ace matters a lot. An ace is 11. So yeah. If you get any face card or a 10 and you get an 11, you win. So Anubis is a winning card for her. On some level, you know, she is paying. If time, you know, watching a screen is the kind of thing that's better than goat's blood for a god like media, then using the Anubis card, getting that card, getting the cards that are named after Egyptian gods might very well help her. That's kind of my theory.
Well, question is that the card she's holding or is that the opposing player's card that's against? Because
it's either way, you're right. I mean, opposing players could be dealt that card. There's no doubt. We see it in her hands once, but as a dealer, you're seeing cards all the time. I'm just guessing that if Anubis is one face card, you know, there are five other face cards in the suite. And then those cards are kind of thrown across four different suites, mm-hmm. Of cards. And so, you know, she's kind of in this theme, and the biggest card of the deck, the Ace of Spades, is Anubis. And that's a card she's always trying to get, which means she's always kind of paying tribute to him. You know, her livelihood comes from paying tribute to Anubis in a weird way. That's kind of where I'm coming from with that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting theory. But and we know sort of Anubis gets pretty angry at Laura and you know mentions that she's entitled to nothing.
Right, let me read that quote. You know, when you said she's kind of feisty or whatever, yeah. I don't know that I like the term, but she's definitely like irreverent is what you said. And she's like, I'm not going in that thing. And he's like, already you are in the ground, tears have fallen for you, death is not a debate. How many do you think have come before you, all with promises and threats and offers of glory, gold, love? Who are you to misguide me from my duty? You are but a man, not even one I should remember. You will go into the darkness, and I will forget ever having met you. But then, later, because she's like, you know, fuck you or whatever, and she gets pulled back from the brink of her doom. You know, he almost gets hit by Audrey's car. He changes from dog form to man form, and he goes, "You, I remember." And it was pretty powerful that this guy who's a god who deals with the dead, so many dead, and he kind of in his first quote he kind of reminds you that like they're possibly, I don't know the math, but there are possibly more people dead than are alive at this point. And over time, you know, there will be more dead people than are alive people unless we find some way to, like, live on other planets and expand incredibly. So there's a lot of dead people, dead faces he sees, you know, billions. And the fact is he doesn't have to remember all of them, but he remembers her.
Right.
So, I mean,
you know why he remembers her? Because it's like
she came back.
Well, yeah. I mean, she was the, because he was about to basically banish her away, and she got sucked away by the gold coin, and then and you saw the look on Anubis's face when
that's some new shit.
So yeah, he would absolutely remember that.
He was like, the water was warm, and damn, she split.
Yeah. I just want to point out one thing here, also one little detail. The casino that she works for is called the 26th Dynasty. And it's interesting to note that the 26th dynasty of Egypt was the last native dynasty to rule Egypt before the Persian conquest. So it's literally like
before the Ptolemaic guys that ended up leading to Cleopatra and those dudes.
It's like the very last, you know, legitimate Egyptian dynasty. So it's interesting to note that that's the you know, baked into the name of the casino that she works with. So why is Laura being judged by Anubis if she doesn't believe in anything, is the question.
I think that she is judged by Anubis, frankly, because if there's a system in which what you believe is what judges you, which we're not really sure of because we've only seen one way to go to the afterworld, and that's through Anubis. I feel as if we're in a place where the closest thing she has to a belief is what's going on in her 26th dynasty casino.
Yeah.
It's as close as it gets. And in their system, in the system of the world they live in, that's what she gets stuck with, you know? That's as close as it is. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like that's the only thing that I can look at the text on and say that this is a real deal, a real thing. So, I mean, I think there's some good stuff there. But other than that, you know, she lives in Eagle Point, and it looks like Jaqel and Ibis also reside in Eagle Point. So maybe they got her by proxy.
All right, we're going to take a break here, and we'll talk about significant changes between the this episode of the series and the book. But before we do, let's talk about a sponsor, Audible.com. The world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. The book we'd like to talk about this week is Good Omens by Neil Gaiman. Dwayne, you want to tell us what Good Omens is about? We know it's a Neil Gaiman, so it's you know, from the same author as American Gods, but what's the story about in this one?
So the premise is that the world will end on Saturday. And that's next Saturday, just before dinner, according to the prophecies of Agnes Nutter, who's a witch. And she's the world's only completely accurate Book of Prophecies writer, who wrote it in 1655. The armies of good and evil are amassing, and everything appears to be going according to the divine plan, except that a somewhat fussy angel and a fast-living demon are not actually looking forward to the coming of the rapture. Someone seems to have misplaced the Antichrist. You know, put the New York Times best-selling authors Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett together, and all hell breaks loose. It's a pretty fun book that ties in not to American Gods, but to the theme of exploring religion in fiction. You know, I mean, the first person to do this in any really meaningful way was Dante with Inferno, and then after that, John Milton with Paradise Lost. Right, these kind of fantastic stories. Told in medieval time, or I guess Renaissance times, that played with notions around some of the apocrypha of the Bible, And this does it. This it's one of those books that kind of falls in the modern tradition of messing around with you know, religion, established and continue and like currently recognized religion, unlike, you know, Norse mythology or whatever. Just like Dogma by Kevin Smith did. So if you're into that kind of fun, playing around with the idea of religion, what it means, how people interact with it, and one author's kind of speculative understanding of it, this is a book for you. Andy, how can people get it?
So we're going to ask people to sign up at audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That's our affiliate link from our other podcast, The Drill Down, which we're using for the time being, in lieu of one specifically for The Dominant Paradigm. To download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 180,000 plus titles, use that URL, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it, and you still get to keep that book for free. I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half-past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No, was all he said. All right, let's talk about some significant changes between this episode of the series, Get Gone, and the book. Dwayne, why don't you start us off?
This week, it was pretty easy. The entire episode is not reflected in the text of American Gods. Right. And that's part of what makes it completely and utterly awesome. And part of what we're talking about at the very top of the show, this idea that this could be, that there's a potential for this to be better than the actual book, because they're bringing in rich new content that makes the story more believable and more emotionally relevant and all that good stuff that we want from drama. Tosin, what do you think? What's the first thing?
Something else we have, the House on the Rock is a haven for shadow outside of Eagle Point, Indiana. And that's where we find Ibis and Anubis's Jackal, or Jackal, however we're saying it this today. But in the TV show, they all exist in Eagle Point. So we're having less locations, less driving time, and all one location.
That's true. Less drive time. I like that. which is, I mean, it's funny because it's a book about the road. But yeah, they did consolidate some stuff there. Another piece, I mean, I said it just a little while ago, Laura's entire backstory, how she ended up with Robbie, who she is. All that stuff, you know, everything from her job at the casino, paying off tuition, to living in her grandmother's old, you know, crappy house, as she called it, the cat. Everything is different, and I think that's super awesome, mm-hmm. super key. Mm-hmm. And as a person who's read the book and is a fan, I couldn't be happier. And which is funny because I think a lot of geeks are looking at shows like this. And when these adaptations depart from the source material, geeks can get cranky, right? Sometimes you hear people saying, give it a rest, nerds. You know, it's a whole new thing. And in this case, I think it's worth taking that position that we have to kind of give it a rest and see what's happening here, because it is far more dramatic and far more, you know, I guess, updated. I mean, Neil Gaiman himself said that there were, if he had unlimited space in a book, he would have written more. But I heard him say that on NPR. But he's talking to one of the hosts on All Things Considered. And, you know, when he's talking to Audie Cornish, you can realize that he's got so much to say. And that's worth noting here. Andy, take us out with the last one in this section.
Yeah, so the last significant change from the book is that whole interaction between Laura and Audrey, the whole, you know, Laura coming back to see Audrey and Audrey sewing up her arm, that entire, like, none of that's in the book at all. That whole, we don't see, I don't think we see Audrey at all in the book after the first part where she's at the funeral,
the lakeside incident.
Yeah.
You see her with
oh, that's right, you know, I forgot
she's
about that.
She's with the chief. But what's really interesting is that, you know, I look at that scene.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, why is Audrey helping the zombie? and I got to say, if you just think about it thematically, Audrey lost her husband and her best friend in the same moment.
Yeah.
And she's really upset at them. But at the same time, she lost, you know, the largest bits of her entire life, right? You lose your best friend and your spouse in the same moment. You also realize why you lost them had a lot to do with the fact that you were excluded from them. And so even if you hate what happened, on some level, you know, Laura is still Audrey's best friend, which makes that completely complicated in terms of, you know, I hate you, and I also want to tell you off. I want to give you a piece of my mind. But at the same time, I miss you. And if anyone's ever been through a breakup, especially a breakup that, you know, ended way poorly, there's this problem where you're effectively angry at your best friend, and you can't talk to your best friend of this thing you're super angry about. And I don't know, these departures from the book, this kind of building out, what did it mean to you guys?
I mean, just the whole dynamic. I really like that whole dynamic between between Audrey and Laura, and it felt really, really authentic, and it felt it felt sort of like after the empirical event of Laura's death, Audrey accepted Laura again as a BFF. You know, and it's sort of like two BFFs hanging together, despite the fact that one of them is, you know, sucked her husband's cock.
Wow. Okay.
So to speak.
Well, I mean, you know, goes to the vulgarity of the situation,
right?
Which is kind of huge, but yeah.
Yeah, you know, I actually really enjoyed the realism that we had in this in these sequences, where, you know, there's and the various emotions, right? It's the fear, there's a bit of the anger / snarkiness, and then there's the acceptance of like, well, you know, at least I have my friend kind of back.
At least kinda. I got chicken.
Yeah, right? At least I got chicken, Leroy Jenkins. So I think that stuff is really well done and made it more grounded, because in the book, none of this interaction ever existed, and giving the audience this filler, I think, was really solid.
Yeah, and it's almost more than filler, right? It's like, it's motivation. You can't just have characters that kind of like swoop in and do stuff. And frankly, who have we seen for the most part so far? We've seen these, you know, supernatural beings that have backstories that go back hundreds or thousands of years. And between Shadow, Audrey, and Laura, we have regular people who, you know, are being acted, characters that are being acted by people who have to, these actors have to figure out these characters without the benefit of that entire history and backstory and all that other stuff. So if they were just kind of there, kind of moving through a straight A to B plot, I think we'd all be somewhat disappointed, because you can't hang, right? You can't hang with the likes of whatever Wednesday is being played by Ian McShane, with whatever backstory that hasn't been revealed yet. When your character is like a 20 something year old or a 30 year old that's trying to figure it all out. So I think that's pretty significant. But speaking of that, let's talk about performances, right? We have pretty much two big performances to talk about this week. Shadow is almost a cameo character, right?
Yeah.
First one, Laura, played by Emily Browning.
Yeah.
And Audrey, obviously, she's played by Betty Gilpin. Let's start with Laura. For me, Emily Browning's performance was incredible, because her rationality combined with her depression seemed oddly real, at the same time unreal. So one symptom of depression is a hyper rational look at the world, which can lead to a feeling of hopelessness. When you're super rational, you know, life can be meaningless, nothing matters, you know, why am I doing this, why am I doing this job, yada yada yada, because the fact is you're born to die, and it doesn't matter what you're doing in the grand scheme, the cosmic scheme of things. And I saw that in Browning. When Laura, you know, when she was deciding to kill herself, when she first met Shadow, when she's making love to Shadow, and right before she slaps him, She looks as if she's about to break into a sob, and then she kind of pulls herself together, and says, you know, I want whatever this physical feeling is, to the point where, you know, the physicality of their relationship almost felt like fuel to help her know she was alive, right? And I also saw Laura when she's explaining to Audrey, the hyper-rationality also worked in there, right? She's like sitting there, she's like, I only really told one lie, and that's the lie I told the shadow.
Right.
Which brings up this point that, you know, we're talking about the fact that shadow is this big bright light for her. We're talking about the fact that, you know, she can see shadow wherever he is. The world is muted except for shadow. Whatever happened, she believes in shadow, right? So even though she rationalizes her affair, maybe her affair was one of those things where, again, she needs to feel something in order to stay. The affair was a means to an end to get back to shadow. And I think that's going to come back in her favor, right? As much as Anubis and Ibis were like, uh-oh, love gets you in trouble. Love is not what it's cracked up to be. I almost feel as if Anubis' whole discussion about how you believed in nothing, so you'll go to darkness, you'll go to nothing, is going to be perhaps usurped by the end of this story. Because if she believes in shadow, and that might be enough to get her to a better place than spending all of eternity in the darkness of a hot tub.
Right.
So I don't know. I was moved. I think that Browning, she's been in soap operas and she's been in a couple movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that's really interesting to me here is that, she has this, you know, to look at her, you see vulnerability. But then
for sure.
The character of, you know, she's small, she's frail kind of thing. I mean, the character of Laura is kind of like, I don't give a fuck. But then the vulnerability is there, and it's the I don't give a fuck that is the veneer. I don't know. I guess I'm done talking. Sorry, guys. What do you think is going on?
Yeah, I mean, don't forget Laura Browning. She was the original Violet Baudelaire from A Series of Unfortunate Events, the movie version. So we've seen her sort of growing up. She was in Sucker Punch as well, again playing a vulnerable character there. But I think vulnerability is her stock and trade. And Betty Gilpin, I mean, she's just a
Nurse Jackie, man.
She's just a dime piece. I have a
what does that mean?
She's a 10. She's like I have a mad crush on Betty Gilpin. She's been in Nurse Jackie. She's been in Masters of Sex. I'm going to be following her career pretty closely. She's got a little touch of.
Last time I heard somebody say that was Palpatine talking to Anakin.
I've ever told you the story of Darth Plagueis the Wise.
We'll be following you very closely.
Wow, guys! Wow.
I'm just saying. Yeah, I mean, she was great. She was great. I think she does bring a very different thing to it. Although, I'll say this: the shots of Betty Gilpin in this show and the clothing that she's wearing and all that stuff,
yeah,
it's not designed to make her the sort of sexual being that she is, like in the other roles she's played. I think she's able to act to her strengths, sure, without having to play on her let's call them physical gifts.
She's also, right? Not the central focus of scenes. It's, you know, these are Laura's scenes and she's the central focus.
Exactly. And not only that, she manages to do that pretty well without kind of stealing the scene.
Yeah.
Because I think that the actor is very capable. And I also think that what's really cool about Betty Gilpin here is that, you know, the fact that she's normally, when you're an object of a scene, the scene is about somebody else. Cameras do focus on your body. But across all the episodes we've seen with her in them, with different directors, you know, they're very focused on the way she's emoting, the distress. She talks about how she's become vulgar. Her character, even though we've seen it a couple times, is apparently not who her character is. In fact, the only time we've really seen her being her is during that kind of barbecue scene pre-affair exposure, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the performances in totality in this episode were just phenomenal. This is why I really enjoyed this episode. You know, one of the things that I was wondering, and I think we discussed a little bit, is about the cartoons that were on TV. That constantly the TV was left on with cartoons. I don't know if it was Laura watching those or if it was the cat, but she would always come home and turn those off. And I think it was either Dwayne or Andy, you both put it very well together that, you know, this is a sign of depression and hopelessness and, you know, turning off the fun.
Yeah, I mean, the cartoon thing, a lot of people leave cartoons on for their pets, and the cat was kind of there and looking at it, and it was interesting. I'm not sure that a cartoon helps if you're a sad person, like a clinically sad person, and I'm no psychiatrist, but a lot of what I saw in Laura reminded me of friends I have who have suffered clinical depression, and obviously the attempts of her life bolster that claim. But I can imagine that something like a cartoon is interesting. But what's more important, though, is if she left that on, she's got an 8-hour shift, then it's highly likely that what she's coming back to is not what she left watching.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not like she's on like a Netflix loop or anything like that. So
could be. She could be on one of those cartoon stations, right? You got those, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Boomerang. Well, why don't we wrap this up? And let's talk about what we hope to see in the upcoming episode.
Okay.
Well, it'll be really interesting to see what Shadow's reaction is to her on his bed. From the book, you would think that he would be very sort of calm and trying to sort of sort out his internal feelings. But from how Shadow's been portrayed so far, you kind of think that he's just like going to freak out and like, you know, be like cowering in the corner, similar to Audrey, but hard to tell. I'm not really sure how that's going to play out.
Speaking of that, just hopping back to Beta Gilpin, that whole scene in the shower, in the bathroom, and I think, Tosin, you actually hit on this very hard. The stages of denial, she kind of went through them all right there, right?
Right.
She's like,
right.
Oh my God, how can you be there? She discusses openly her grief, her anger, what it's done to her, and you see she hasn't quite moved on. I mean, there's that book that she was making for Shadow's Return, and rather than sort of throwing it out or anything, it's the thing that Laura finds in a place where it would have been worked on. So you know, Audrey hasn't been back there since she worked on that, it seems, right? So that whole moment in the bathtub, she's clutching the shower curtain. Her best friend is one-armed, and you know, she claims that fluid is coming out of every part of her body, like embalming fluid. She's dead. She can't smell great, and she's just there. And she's like, and then we see her in a car, and some driving her and talking, and somehow that's believable, right? It's not like, I mean, there's a what the fuck is going on, right? Kind of moment, I think, for anybody viewing that. But somehow it's believable that this woman, and I, for reasons that I mentioned before, is able to communicate with this dead person and be okay with that. And that was surprising. I also wonder what the hell Jackal and Ibis were doing walking across the random road. You know?
Well, you know, again, I think that's sort of engineered to make it different from the book, because in the book, all of that stuff occurs with, you know, Shadow meets Jackal. We're introduced to Jackal and Ibis when Shadow meets them, and not Laura. So I think they had to sort of engineer an introduction.
Right. And for anyone who's wondering why they would work on her body after, you know, Audrey did, you know, Audrey is got some sewing thread and things like for cloth. And they've got exactly what's going on. So, I mean, we mentioned that before, but I thought that was interesting how willingly she was able to lie down there and get that stuff done. So also one other thing was the sex scene. Every episode there's a sex scene.
Last week, we didn't talk about this. Of course, yes.
Yeah, last week the sex scene was the two guys from Oman. And weeks before it had been Bilquis, the goddess of love, or Queen of Sheba. This week we see Shadow and his wife, and again there's this idea that like she's feeling through him, like she's exposed to life. But there is that moment where, you know, after the initial scene where they hook up, they're making love and she's looking out the window toward the tub, and it's almost immediately after that she's like, we have to rob this bank, not the bank, the casino, mm-hmm. in order for me to feel something or whatever. She doesn't really explain it, but he loves her, so he's willing to do it, even though it's clear that she doesn't love him the way he loves her, because she's like, he's like, I could live under a bridge with you, and she's like, that would be a failure to me. Which I think a lot of people look at and they understand, right? So I don't know. I just thought the whole sex scene, there's a lot of agency there. She decides that she wants him. She brings him home. She you know, physically kind of attacks him a little bit during that. She wants him to, you know, in old time terms, it's a taker, that kind
right,
of thing.
Right.
So it was it was pretty powerful the way it was portrayed. So yeah, I mean, what do you think about that?
I mean, no, basically you covered it. I think it's not as provocative as the sex scenes we've seen in the last couple of episodes, but it's
less nudity, but way more gratuitous in a way, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Like, it's not like you see, like, you know, breast bouncing or like penises anywhere or whatever, but it's gratuitous and it's kind of what's it? It's, I don't know, it's not quite, you know, BDSM or anything, but it's definitely like there's a domination aspect there.
Anything that you're looking forward to seeing in this upcoming episode?
I like Tosin said, what's going to happen when Shadow sees her? And you know, what's the plan? Like, all these people are headed toward someplace in Wisconsin. We don't quite know.
Right.
The departure from the book is set now.
Yeah.
And, you know, also, what's going to happen to Sweeney? I want to see more Sweeney, because Sweeney's more supremely Sweeney. Entertaining to me. This incarnation, this depiction of Mad Sweeney.
Pablo Schreiber, you know, his Mad Sweeney is on point. So, yeah, I'd love to see more of him.
Is he a dime piece?
He's not. He might be a dime piece to some, not to me. Betty Gilpin still has that spot, unfortunately.
I'm sure she'll be very platted.
Let's talk about ephemera, like additional links that would help our listeners enhance their enjoyment of this show. Tosin, you have a link?
Yeah, I have one. It is a book called The Complete Book of Sewing, a practical step-by-step guide to sewing techniques in the case you ever need to fix a friend's limbs. This might come in handy.
A dead friend's limbs.
Yeah, or if you're just want to learn how to sew. So it's a very good skill to have.
If you want to do some amateur autopsy work, then yeah, for sure, you can get into this.
You know what got me kind of strangely?
Yeah.
When you see Laura pop out of the ground, you can see her autopsy kind of scars, or her, like, maybe her organ removal, whatever was happening there. But when she was in the coffin, you couldn't. So I thought that was interesting, because the dress was, let's call it, it was a modest conservative dress. I also thought it was really incredible, again, this rationality she has. You know, her arm comes off and she's just walking down the street with an arm in hand, and she just doesn't give a fuck. There's also something interesting about the actress in terms of the way she moves. She always looks as if she's limping for whatever reason. I don't know if that's an effect or whatever, but it also adds to that vulnerability.
Well, she did have that one slipper,
But even when she was working in the casino, in whatever kind of practical shoes casinos workers work in, she looked like she was limping. Which I noticed. I didn't notice it, but then I looked at it again, because I was wondering if there was something that she was stepping on or whatever. But yeah, the whole one shoe thing, she kicks it off. And it's also like, you guys ever notice when there's just one shoe in the road?
Sometimes.
You ever see that?
Sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a dead person, come back to life. Thanks, Dwayne. Sleep well, everyone.
Speaking of sleeping, it's time to get out of here.
Yeah.
Tosin, where can we find you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. Find R2D2 work at toastr2.tumblr.com, and you can also find me on Geeks of Doom. What about yourself, Dwayne?
Check me out on Geeks of Doom, on DwayneD.com, on Twitter.com/DwayneD. All of that is DwayneD. And Andy will tell you how you can hear all of us elsewhere. Andy, where can we find you? What's up?
Yeah, so you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. That's my social media handle. Or just do a Google search for Andrew Sorsini or Mr. Babyman, and you'll find everything that I like and link online throughout the week there. As far as the three of us go, we do have another podcast, a tech podcast called The Drill Down, which is also on this network, the Geeks of Doom Podcast Network. We as well have been covering Westworld. We covered Westworld Season 1, and you can find that at Violent Delights, which is, again, on the Geeks of Doom podcast network. Just look up Violent Delights in iTunes, and you'll find us there. And, of course, every week here on The Dominant Paradigm for Starz American Gods. And we're going to see you guys for the next episode of American Gods, which is titled Lemon Scented You. I have to imagine that that's got to be about Laura's increasing
putridity.
So I can't wait to see that, and we'll see you guys next week. Thanks,
guys.